and that's find Angelique Badeau. You're nuts. A little bit of crazy never hurt. Asking the wrong questions can. He has a point there. Another bell, ringing from inside the Technical Institute. This one is followed by more noise. The stir of hundreds of kids, squeaking back chairs, popping open doors, stomping down halls. Lunch break. Which brings me back to my original task, and yet another reason to ditch official police presence. I signal my departure with a wave, then head back toward the street corner. Detective Lotham stays where he is, watching me go. I disappear into the student traffic as it expels from the academy's front doors and pours down the steps. I count to five. When I look back, the detective is no longer in sight, just as I'd hoped. I allow myself a single smile, then I go back to work. Chapter 7. Teenagers are loud. It feels to me like there are hundreds of them, swarming across the street, forming smaller pools on the sidewalk, then flooding into the corner grocer. No school uniforms. The kids wear ripped jeans or spandex tights, paired with sports tops, flannel shirts, or long fall sweaters. All in all, I'm not dressed that differently, which, given the age gap, is probably not a good thing. I try to focus on the girls, parsing out individual faces. Gerline listed Angelique's BFFs as Kira and Marjorie. Unfortunately, I have no idea what they look like. Detective Lotham and his cohorts have most likely vacuumed Angelique's social media accounts for every crumb of information by now. They should know her life inside and out, from her family and friends to her favorite foods, zodiac sign, and nervous habits. I have none of that. At least not yet. I consider myself old school. I talk to people versus reading tweets. I ask questions versus consulting forensic reports. Obviously, it's harder for me to get that kind of access. On the other hand, by the time I arrive on scene, months, maybe years later, none of those leads has made a difference, so I stick to my track phone and my gumshoe spirit. I pick a place near the epicenter of Teenville and resume my recon. The student population is the most diverse I've seen in a bit. Dozens of African Americans interspersed with pockets of Indian, Latin, and Asian kids. I think most are speaking English, but given that I can't follow any of the conversations, it appears to be some dialect known only by teens. I notice that other pedestrians are now crossing the street to avoid the mass of high schoolers. I don't blame them. Angelique was 15 at the time of her disappearance. It follows that her friends would have been 15 then as well, making them 16 now. So, two 16-year-old girls. Except most of the females in this crowd look to be anywhere from 18 to 21. Did I ever look that fresh and pretty? In high school, I'd never been one to hang out with groups or join teams. My father told me I was a free spirit, but really, I was awkward and self-conscious. Until I had a couple of beers. Then, the world was my oyster. I fucked the quarterback, blew off classes, and danced with abandon. I remember feeling like my hometown was too small and my skin too tight, and I wanted to simultaneously burst upon the world and lock myself inside my room. I loved my drunken, irresponsible father. I hated my demanding, critical mother. I wished for bigger boobs and a smaller waist and that girl's hair and this girl's gorgeous skin. Whatever I had wasn't what I wanted. But what did I want? I had no idea. These poor kids, I think now. Like this whole age isn't confusing enough without adding in a missing classmate. Yellow ribbons. It takes me a minute to spot the pattern, Not just a random accessory pinned to one girl's top or stuck on one guy's shoulder, but half a dozen of them attached to various students. In honor of Angelique, has to be. Last winter, most of the student body probably had worn them, but now, 1 month into the start of a new school year without any fresh developments, her friends would still be making the effort. I spy two ribbon-wearing girls standing side by side in animated conversation with a third teen. One of the girls has beautiful black skin, high cheekbones, and thickly lashed eyes. She is clutching the blue straps of her backpack on her shoulders, her gaze constantly working the street, even as she chatters away with her classmates. Hypervigilant, I know how that feels. I work my way through the cluster of kids. A few nod, most cast suspicious glances. I'm definitely persona non grata. I close in on the trio of girls. The restless one notes my approach first. Her dark eyes narrow. She stops talking, then whacks the girl closest to shut up. Bit by bit, the kids nearest to us fall into wary silence. I feel like a gazelle walking through a pack of lions. Same rules of survival apply. Make no sudden moves. Show no fear. I come to a halt in front of the strap-clutching girl. She stares straight at me, expression already set. Marjorie? Kira? I ask. Who wants to know? I'm Frankie Elkin. I'm here to find Angelique. The girl laughs. It's a harsh sound. Lady, if you're looking for the suburbs, you already made, like, four wrong turns. Kira? I guess. The shorter girl next to her startles. My target rolls her eyes. Marjorie, but nice try. She's lying. I know that instantly, both by her tone and by the response of the kids around us. Some are surprised, but most are smirking. A challenge for the crazy lady, who's clearly dumb as shit to think she can barge into their world demanding answers for things she can't possibly know anything about. I know how to take a hit. Now is not the time for fighting back. Angelique's Aunt Gerline suggested I speak with both of you. If I could have a moment? The third girl backs up and away, but Kira and Marjorie remain planted. Gotta get back to school, the tall girl states. Her dark hair is fixed into a complicated mix of braids, pulled back from her face and fashioned into a wrapped crown, which further emphasizes her stunning cheekbones. The girl is drop-dead gorgeous. Never an easy trait in a best friend. 10 minutes. I gesture to the ribbon she has pinned to her deep purple top. Or is that just for show? Fuck you! The shorter girl stirs. She's pretty, but not stunning. No doubt she and Angelique formed the background for their flashier friend. But that also meant, of the three, she and Angelique shared the tighter bond. Please, I say quietly. I spread my hands in a show of submission. Just a couple of questions. I direct my gaze at the tall stunner. Kira. I address her directly, just so she knows that I know that she's already lied to me. The shorter girl, Marjorie, gazes up at her friend. Her glossy black hair is a riot of unbelievably tiny ringlets. It's a nice fit with her round face, clear brown eyes. I want to lean in and tell her that she's beautiful too, but I already know that's not how the world feels to her. Her friend is gorgeous. She's cute. Kira leads, Marjorie follows. She must miss Angelique terribly. Fine, Kira exclaims suddenly, but you're wasting your time. Because Angelique doesn't want to be found. Because we don't need some skinny-ass white lady trying to save her soul by slumming it in the ghetto. Come on, have you looked in the mirror? This ain't your neighborhood. She delivers this with the kind of disdain only a teenager can muster. I take the second hit, surrendering the battle but focusing on the war as I lead Kira and Marjorie away from the pack. Their classmates have already grown bored with the show. My initial appearance had been interesting, but Angelique's case is old news. Nothing of interest here. How long have you known Angelique? I ask casually.
6 years.
Marjolie speaks first, her voice soft, her gaze cast down. I live near her in Mattapan. My family is Haitian, too.
Kira shrugs. 2 years. When we both started at Boston Academy, I used to steal Angel's notes. Eventually, she began giving them to me, told me she never minded helping a friend. So then, you know, we became friends. Angel's like that. She has this way.
Kira shrugs again.
She's way too good to be, like, missing, you know? But she's got hidden reserves. She's gonna come home. Just you wait and see.
Kira's nostrils flare. I get the impression this has been a lot of words for her, and she meant every one of them. Beside her, Marjolie is nodding. I've worked 14 missing persons cases. I volunteer. All around the country. Missing kids, missing adults. You know the one thing they all had in common? The girls wait. I have their attention now. The victims' own families, even the ones they loved and who loved them, still didn't know them. Not all the pieces, the jagged edges, the still forming dreams. I think in the end, no parent or sibling truly can. That's where friends come in. Angelique's aunt, her brother, they see what they've always seen, combined with what they want to see. But you two? You knew Angelique. You are the family she chose for herself. Marjolie looks like she's going to cry. Even Kira has lost her edge. She appears younger, less certain. She glances at Marjolie, who now appears scared. Why scared? A bell rings, shrill and insistent. Behind us, the kids begin gathering up their belongings. I make it quick. Did Angelique have enemies at school? Kids who threatened her? Kids she threatened?
We stuck together, Kira says. Watched each other's backs. And don't you go talking smack about my girl. Angel never threatened no one in her life.
What about gangs?
No way. Academy's neutral ground. Principal Bastion says first time she catches wind of a gang sign or threat, that's it. We'll be wearing school uniforms.
I translate that to mean the uniforms are the threat, and Kira and her peers are taking it seriously.
Marjolie adds, Angel wasn't the kind to call attention to herself. She's woke, you know? Sensitive to others, but unlike some others who always gotta be making a fuss.
She and Kira exchange knowing glances. Marjolie continues.
Most of the kids in our school, they didn't even know Angel's name till the police showed up asking questions.
I understand about half of what Marjolie said, but with the sea of kids preparing to exit, now is not the time. Boyfriend? I prod. The girls exchange a glance. Marjolie is uncomfortable. Kira sets her jaw. Yes, Angel had a boyfriend. I fill in.
No,
Kira corrects. At least, we don't know. Marjolie clarifies quickly.
Angel came back to school last year. Different. We teased her.
Had to be a boy,
Kira interjects flatly.
She said no.
Lost the big V. Still think so.
Kira glances haughtily at her friend.
Not gonna convince me otherwise. Good for her.
She would have told us, Marjorie insists. Why keep it a secret?
Maybe he's batshit ugly.
Marjolie huffs out a breath, turns to me.
Kira just likes to pretend she knows Angel the best. Summer before last year, I was the one who spent 2 months with Angel at the rec center. There were no boys. I mean, no one special.
And did Angelique have a job?
Babysitting, but she also helped out with her brother, so it's not like she had tons of time.
But you're saying she returned to school in the fall different?
How so?
More exchanged glances.
I think Stella found her groove.
Kira drawled. Marjolie shook her head.
She was just distracted, big time, Kira again.
She started giving me class notes with only half the material, and when I asked, it was like she didn't even know. She'd, like, space out or something, from Mrs. Braintrust to Mrs. Wish You Were Here.
Did she seem scared, distracted, or dreamy, distracted?
Distant, Marjorie murmured. She seemed distant, but also like more solidly herself, like she was alone, even when she was with us. But to her, maybe that wasn't such a bad thing.
I think I understand. Together but separate. I know that feeling well. Across the street, the bell tones at a more insistent volume. The girls edge toward the street. Their classmates are already departing, exerting fierce gravitational pull. I speak faster.
She changed her clothes that Friday after school. Do you know why?
Both girls shake their heads, take a couple more steps. I quickly follow.
Did you see her after she changed? Maybe she'd put on a dress? Day clothes?
More negative headshakes, more shifting sideways.
Okay, one last question. Side door of the school, the one you guys use for smuggling in contraband, how do you prop it open? Is there a rock, stick, pencil for jamming the lock?
Both girls startle, stare at me.
You need to go. I need answers. Quick.
My insistent tone, combined with the demanding bell, does the trick.
Can't prop it open. Marjorie murmurs rapidly, voice low. The janitor checks. Kids bring a friend or two. Couple of kids do the spotting while the third runs out and grabs whatever.
So when Angelique went back into school Friday afternoon, which of you held the door?
Kira and Marjorie drop short, faces paling.
What?
Marjorie asks first. The police know she re-entered the school using the side door in order to change her clothes. Then she hid her backpack.
The police already know that. You're not ratting her out. Please, 11 months is long enough. It's time to put it all on the line.
The police never mentioned.
Kira, already sounding angry. The police don't disclose information, but I can. Help me, and I'll keep you informed. I'm begging, pleading. One last shrill alarm from inside the school, followed by cars honking on the street, where we're now holding up traffic. I want to grab Marjorie's arm, but will myself not to. They know something. Not about this side door, which has appeared to catch them completely off guard, but about the new Angelique who returned from summer vacay. I need to know that something. Detective Lotham has his surveillance videos. I have this.
It wasn't us, Marjorie says suddenly. We didn't do it. We didn't even know she went back inside. When the police said they found her backpack on the school grounds, we wondered.
She flickers a glance at Kira.
But we honestly had no idea. We're her friends, Kira mutters stiffly. Her best friends.
Then I have to ask again, who are her enemies? More honking while the last of the bell fades away.
The police are wrong, Kira declares flatly. Angel wasn't like that. She wouldn't keep secrets. She wouldn't backstab her friends, and she sure as hell.
Whatever the girl is about to say, she bites it off. One last glare at me, then she grabs Marjorie's hand and they both bolt for the academy steps. I'm alone in the middle of the street with plenty of cars willing to tell me about it. I take the first step back toward the sidewalk, still thinking. They're lying. Angel's friends, her brother, they all know more than they're saying. And yet they also seem genuinely concerned and want her back. Meaning? I make a quick stop in the corner market to grab water and dash a bunch of notes in my spiral notebook. Then I realize I need to do some hustling of my own in order to get to work on time. I exit the grocer and round the corner to what I hope is the correct bus stop, casting a glance over my shoulder out of sheer habit. which is when I see him, a tall, skinny black male standing across the way, staring straight at me. At least 6'4", anywhere from late 20s to late 30s, wearing a blue nylon tracksuit with a thick gold chain around his neck, like he last got dressed in the early 2000s. Cars zoom between us. When they've passed, he's gone. But the shiver of unease follows me back to the bar. Chapter 8. Returning to Stoney's dim interior feels like a balm after spending half the day out in the big city. I draw in a lungful of grease, salt, and hops as I tie a white apron around my waist and prepare for battle. I know this bar's fragrance as well as I know the feel of the beer taps and the sound of a bell. Order up! I like Stoney's. Not just because it's a no-frills joint where you get what you get, but because it's the local watering hole. I've worked in dozens of bars across dozens of cities. I could make much more in some upmarket, aspirational place, but I remain partial to the kind of pub that feels like home. When I check in, I find Stoney tucked inside a tiny office next to the kitchen. He looks me up and down, maybe checking for piper damage. "Got 3 menu items," he says, ticking off on his fingers. "Cheeseburger and fries, $10. Chicken wings and fries, $10. Only fries, $5. He turns back to his archaic desktop. At least that explains the lack of menu. I linger for a second, in case he wants to walk me through setup, maybe review some custom drinks. Nope, nothing. Apparently, 3 minutes of instruction is all it takes to run this joint. Fair enough. I unstack the chairs from the tables, wipe every available surface. Napkin holders, check. Salt and pepper shakers, cheap promotional coasters. Then it's time to check keg lines and clear the soda gun, followed by drying and stacking glasses, filling bowls of spicy peanuts, slicing up lemons and limes. I like the work. Quick and mindless, it allows my attention to wander. Emmanuel Badeau and his look of suspicion. Detective Lotham and his look of hostility. Angelique's friend Marjolie and her look of fear. I don't know my own expression at this stage of my investigation. Confusion? Intrigue? Most of my work has been in remote areas where there's been a lack of resources or small-minded police departments stocked with good old boys who don't want to waste their time. Or, say, tribal police who really believe outsiders need not apply. As a city, Boston is definitely not that, and yet some of the same defensiveness applies. Did I once feel the sting of barbed comments or fear being shut out, told I was wrong or stupid? Did I feel guilty for ruffling so many feathers? If I did, it was a long time ago. Before I was stopped on an open road in the middle of the desert, the blacktop wavy with heat, as a county sheriff and his 3 deputies climbed out of their cruisers, smacking their batons in cadence with their approach. Before the crack of a rifle shattered the rear window of my rental car as I skidded sideways into a bank of heavy trees, more windows imploding, airbag deploying, my nose breaking. Before a screaming uncle pulled me from his sister's front porch, punching me and crying that it was all my fault, then falling to his knees and simply crying because his 6-year-old niece was never coming home, and maybe he shouldn't have drunk himself into oblivion the night he was babysitting. Memories sear. I have so many of them now. They're not precious moments, but burning hot coals I keep picking up and turning over in my mind. They hurt. I study them harder. They burn deeper. I come back for more. Paul accused me of remaining an addict, even after I stopped drinking. I don't think he understood. That's exactly how it works. I am my demons, and my demons are me. Some days I do all the talking, and some days my monster does all the drinking, but every day it's all me. Viv arrives with a hum and a wave as the first few customers walk in. I receive wary glances from most of my customers. I am, for the moment at least, the only white person in the room. But I keep the alcohol coming, and as hour speeds into busier hour, with me smoothly drawing down draft beers, pouring out shots, tossing in limes, everyone settles. I deliver food slips to Viv, pick up waiting plates for tables. Stoney and I fall into an easy shorthand of numbered fingers as he splits his time between back kitchen and front counter. We pass quickly from an easy happy hour to a hopping dinner rush to the late-hour locals who have nowhere else to be at 10 o'clock on a work night. I zip back a tray of dirty glasses, placing them in the bottom of the vast stainless steel sink and topping them with steaming hot water. Then I'm back at the bar, looking for the next drink order. Detective Lotham takes a seat in front of me. No gray suit, but jeans and a navy blue sweater that stretches across his broad chest. Off duty, then. He regards me. Friend or foe? He's still debating the matter, which means time for more fun. What can I get you? Wait, let me guess. Bourbon? Neat. His brow furrows. Good God, no. Corona? Though he didn't seem the type. Rum chata. Seriously? Around here, real men drink rum. I shake my head, reach up for the simple white bottle. I'd never even heard of the liqueur till this evening. Now, I'd received multiple orders for it. It reminds me of a Caribbean version of Bailey's, except it's lighter in color and smells like rice pudding topped with cinnamon. I'd asked Viv about it during one of my kitchen excursions. She'd muttered darkly about Cremas, Christmas time, and I'd better demand a raise by then. Now I get out a half glass, scoop in ice, douse it in white boozy sweetness, then push it toward the detective. One girly drink for the big guy. I'll be back. I head to the other end of the bar, topping off water for one customer, pouring fresh beers for three more. I keep my movements easy, my face bright, and pretend I don't feel Detective Lotham's stare burning a hole in my back. A wave from the corner booth. I walk around to take an order for three burgers from a trio of elderly gentlemen who seem to be having a very good time. The one closest to me gestures me closer. You the new girl Viv was talking about? He has gray whiskers, sparkling brown eyes, and a mischievous smile. I'm willing to bet he was hell on wheels back in the day. And that day might have been yesterday. I'm the new girl, I confirm. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, girlie. That Viv give you any trouble, you come find me. I'll set her straight. Viv? You're offering to protect me from Viv? That's right. She can be uppity. Bossy, too. And I should know. I'm her big brother. That's so. Albert. Nice to meet you, Albert. But I'm afraid I'm going to have to be blunt. We both know that you're no match for Viv. Thanks for the offer, though. The man's friends chortle across the table. My customer's grin broadens. Whatever the test, apparently I passed it. A parting wink, then I deliver the order slip to Viv, informing her that she has a table of admirers, including older brother Al. She merely rolls her eyes and drops down another bucket of fries. I escape before the greasy steam coats my skin. Back at the bar, I notice Lotham's drink has been barely touched. Apparently, he's planning on staying for a while. With the bar pared down to the night owls, there's nothing that demands my immediate attention. I plop my elbows on the counter across from the Boston cop. So, of all the gin joints in all the towns in the world? He smiles briefly. I had some time on my hands. Wanted a drink. Really? Because I think you're still rankled that the new girl is sniffing around your turf. You didn't leave the school after our conversation. Never said I was gonna. You talked to students, Kira and Marjorie. I liked their yellow ribbons. Detective Lotham takes a sip of his rum chata. When he sets it down and exhales, his breath smells like cinnamon. He has dark eyes, thick eyebrows, and battered features. His nose has definitely been broken, probably a couple of times, and he's missing a piece of his ear, as if someone took a bite out of it. There's a story there, no doubt. I like that about his face, that it's a roadmap of been there, done that. It's interesting. In my drinking days, I devoted my share of nights to drunken hookups. Even back then, it wasn't about the sex for me, which was generally a clumsy and forgettable affair. I liked the quiet right after, when neither of us were speaking, just the sound of chests heaving, heartbeats slowing, that short, fleeting moment that occurs right before regret. When you can smell the sweat on your body, now mixing with someone else's, and wonder again how you can remain so disconnected. Like it wasn't your arms, wasn't your legs, was never your body to begin with. I wouldn't invite a man like Detective Lotham up to my room for sex, but even now, I wouldn't mind tracing the line of his chewed-up ear, his weathered jawline. I stand, putting distance between us, then pour myself a glass of water and down it. I called the names you gave O'Shaughnessy, Lotham offers up casually. And? Wouldn't say they sang your praises, but it does sound like you're legit. I mean, as legit as an inexperienced, untrained civilian can be. I'll take that as a compliment. No seeking of financial reward or attention from the press. I shudder automatically. I don't care for the press. Lotham nods before he can stop himself, then scowls, as if I tricked him into having something in common with me. Are you a good detective? I ask Lotham. He doesn't take the bait. I think you are. You and the BPD have all the bells and whistles you could ask for, not to mention access to way more information than I can get. For example, I had to interview Marjorie and Kira to learn if Angelique had a boyfriend. Well, you probably know every detail from dumping Angelique's phone, searching her laptop, surfing her social media. And yet you still stopped by tonight to learn what her two friends told me. Interesting. I push away, drift down the bar to take a new drink order, settle a bill. When I return, Detective Lotham has sipped infinitesimally more of his drink. This time, he doesn't bother with pretenses. What did Marjorie and Kira have to say? I'll show you mine, you show me yours. One arched, bushy brow. Let's both pretend that means yes. I plant my elbows on the countertop. Something changed in Angelique's life the summer before she disappeared. She returned to school more self-possessed, distant, distracted. Kira thinks a boy and serious enough to be sexual. Marjorie disagrees, but mostly because it hurts her feelings to think her bestie kept such a secret. How long did you talk to them? 5-8 minutes before lunch break was over. And they told you about their friend's sex life? Think of it as girl talk. See, a civilian investigator isn't so bad. Lotham takes a pointed slurp of his drink. My turn. I'm sure you have copies of Angelique's text messages, but what about Snapchat? That's what most teens use for communicating away from prying parental eyes. I imagine they think it's covert, disappearing messages and all that. But is it? Can you recover a message that vanishes the moment it's read? The police can get Snapchat info. How? The messages pass through the closest server. The server captures the data. But how do you know which servers to access when people use their phones walking all over the place? It's never a bad idea to start with the areas closest to home, school, and work. Won't get everything, but will get enough. What about messages sent in an app? You know, utilizing Instagram or some of the specialized messaging apps. That's what search warrants are for. I nod. Makes sense. For every new medium of communication comes a new way to capture that form of communication. All right. Let's say it's been, I don't know, 11 months since an investigation first started. By now, you have your search warrant results, server data, cell phone dump. Unless it involves something being unlocked by Apple, in which case we're still in court. I smile. Man, you're a pain in the ass. Tell me, did all this new information scored by the search warrants and recovered from miscellaneous servers confirm your initial theory of the case? or alter it completely?
I look him in the eye.
Do you still think Angelique was changing clothes Friday night to meet a mystery lover?
Lotham's turn to smile. He sips his drink.
He's not going to answer that question, and we both know it. It's okay. Whether he intended or not, he's done me a favor, as just knowing what information is out there is half the battle. Some of the reports received by the police I can request copies of through the Freedom of Information Act, things like that. In this case, that probably won't work, but I can also ask Angelique's Aunt Gerline if she'd be willing to ask for copies. Most families have no idea what the police have been doing behind the scenes and are frustrated about being left in the dark. Meaning, my suggestion that they ask for a specific document almost always leads to instant results, and yet more cops who hate me.
You're thinking boyfriend, I say now. I can tell by the look on your face that what Kira and Marjolie told me wasn't news.
You probably already read the messages, buzzed through the photos. Good Lord. The hour after hour of teen drama you must have had to wade through. Kids keep everything on their phone.
I pause for dramatic effect.
Except not Angelique. That phone in her bag wasn't her real cell. She's got a backup, probably a cheap burner, where her real life happens, which is why she was comfortable leaving her parentally approved model behind.
In front of me, Lotham thins his lips. Flares his nostrils. I've been working on the thought all afternoon. Judging by Lotham's expression, I'm right. But where does that leave us? I have a second thought, sadder, more sobering. Why Detective Lotham is really here. Because he gets it too. That nearly a year later, he's no closer to the truth. And he's troubled by that, both by what he's seen and by what he can't see. He doesn't want me getting involved. No detective wants that. But at the same time, what if my blundering jars something loose? Detective Lotham doesn't approve of me, but he's also desperate. And like any good detective, he knows he doesn't have to like me to use me as a resource. I push away from the bar again, nodding at the customer trying to get my attention. While I'm up and at it, I deliver Viv's burgers to the flirty trio, noticing all three burgers are topped with her special sauce, family connections paying off. I wipe down two recently vacated tables. Scrubbing the surface with my fraying dish towel gives me more time to think. It's after 11 now, only half a dozen customers and 45 minutes left till closing. I return to the bar and my position across from Lotham. Officer O'Shaughnessy was warning me about the gang activity in this area, dozens of them willing to kill over a single block of real estate. I did some reading of my own, you know, before I waded inexperienced and untrained into the lion's den. There was a local case a few years back. A gang needed to lure out a rival in order to kill him. But their faces, their girlfriends, were too well known. So they recruited a new girl with no history of gang activity, had one of the females befriend her. Couple of months later, at her new friend's request, that girl invites the rival to meet her at the park for a date. He shows up. Further statistics ensue. I tilt my head at Lotham. Angelique would be a good target for that kind of scheme. Shy, quiet girl, also innocent and pretty. Maybe she was befriended. Maybe threatened, but for whatever reason, she ended up in a situation beyond her control.
I remember that case.
Lotham nods.
There was a retaliatory shooting shortly thereafter. Killed three more.
But if that's what this is, I contemplate, once again leaning in close. Why didn't she come home when it was over? Unless something worse happened? A shooting followed by a retaliatory shooting, like you mentioned? But in that case, you'd have a bunch of cops deployed to those scenes, and one of them should have seen or heard about Angelique.
True. Plus, there's another problem with that scenario.
Do tell.
Gangbangers don't fly.
It takes me a second, then I get it.
If Angelique were meeting up with new friends and/or gangsters, there should still be some image caught on video. Maybe cameras missed the blip of a moment when Angelique appeared here or crossed there. But for her to head deeper into the hood, traversing neighborhoods and parks, whether by foot, subway, or car, no way some camera somewhere didn't capture her image. By now, I wouldn't be surprised if Detective Lotham hadn't personally viewed all possible video feeds dozens of times. I've done it myself, poring over maps again and again. It's how I found Lainey Whitehorse, because in the end, the lake was the only place she could have gone, regardless of the tribal police saying there were no tire marks in the mud or flattened bushes along the shore to indicate an accident and justify the cost of a water search. I don't know why that was, or how an ancient Chevy went from a hairpin turn to 30 yards out into a lake without leaving any trace behind. Maybe not all things are meant to be understood. Of course, in Angelique's case, there remains one other terrible, awful scenario. Sex trafficking, I murmur now. Innocent girls are often lured into the life. Angelique fits the description as that kind of target as well, meaning maybe she thought she was going on a date with a new man in her life, except I shrug. She never got to come home. Lotham doesn't answer right away. He spins his drink, watching the white liqueur coat the chips of ice. Boston has a human trafficking unit. They can reach out to CIs, run facial rec against all the local sex services sites, partner with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Prostitution is no longer a street game. It's gone digital, just like everything else. Customers log in, peruse the menu, place the order. Sick, to be sure, but it does allow us to cover a lot more ground using cybertech. Let's just say the human trafficking unit has nothing new to report. Stoney appears at the end of the bar, clad in his usual worn jeans and blue chambray shirt. He looks at his watch. 2 minutes to midnight by my count, but apparently close enough for him, as he raps the bar 3 times hard with his fist. Last call. Customers toss back drinks, rise to standing, cash out accounts, one by one, till only Detective Lotham remains. Stoney gives him a look, seems to decide he's nothing to fear, then retreats to the kitchen. I yawn. Gonna help me clean? I ask, starting to stack up dirty glasses. I'm trying to figure you out. If only someone could. You really don't work for money. And give up this kind of reckless abandon? You literally go from place to place, case to case, no time off, no life, no loved ones in between. Like, what, some kind of modern-day gunslinger? Yes, there are that many open missing persons cases out there. I could travel from town to town, investigation to investigation for the rest of my life, and still not make a dent in the number. Why? Lotham downs the last of his drink. He stands up from the stool, then makes his way around the bar till he's standing right in front of me. His eyes aren't so flat now. They're dark and deep and endless. He really does want to know. If only I had the answer. I think Kira and Marjorie were right, I murmur. If Angelique had met a boy, she would have told them. Maybe not her aunt and her brother, but her 2 best friends, they would have known. But most likely, she had met someone. And what kind of someone would a teenage girl hesitate to introduce immediately to her inner circle?
An older man?
Or a new female friend? Someone who might be good for Angelique, but threatening to her posse. Teenage girls don't always take that kind of change well. Lotham's studying me intently, still trying to turn me inside out so he can understand all the gearings, see exactly what makes me tick. I wish it were really that simple, but he remains frustrated, and I remain my same old self, thoughts whirling, skin humming, anxiety flying.
He steps back, away, heads for the door. I follow him, preparing to lock up behind. Beyond the bar, the street is cast in pools of light and shadow. The air is colder, the pedestrian traffic scant, with roamers keeping their heads down and feet fast. I'm going to focus on potential new friends in Angelique's world, as well as her missing burner phone. I tell Lotham as he steps into the night.
Can't buy a prepaid cell en masse under the age of 18.
Never stopped a teenager before. He shakes his head, clearly annoyed by my persistence, but not surprised.
Be careful out there. Bad things can happen, even in daylight.
It's cute you think I'm waiting for daylight. I shut the door, firing the bolt home while Lotham is still whipping around in shock. A final wave, then I head back to the bar to finish cleaning up before starting my next adventure. Chapter 9. The world would be a better place if more people spent time drinking cheap coffee in church basements. So many think we must share the same beliefs to get along. In my experience, sharing the same fear is a far more effective strategy. By the time I find my way down the stairs of the Congregational Church, I'm slightly out of breath. I claim a folding metal chair toward the back where I can get the lay of the land. The room, like so many I've sat in before, has commercial gray carpet, a drop ceiling, and walls covered in a combination of children's art and framed Bible passages. It smells like coffee and mildew. Once more, I'm the only white person in the room. Here, however, I can shed the label of outsider. In this room, race, gender, age, ethnicity, income level, these things don't matter. Interestingly enough, neither does religion. While AA was founded on the principle of God, over the years its lingo has evolved to recognize a more general higher power. Call it what you want, even atheists have some kind of spirituality. The point is, we're all here because we recognize we have a problem with alcohol. We desire sobriety and understand that, in this matter, we need help to get the job done. Already, other AAs are turning to offer a nod of greeting, a hand in welcome. From a grizzled old war vet in an army jacket, to a young black kid in a t-shirt, to a woman still folding up her cook's apron, we introduce ourselves, even before the meeting has started. I have a hard time catching all the names or understanding all the accents, but I smile and mean it. Another basic tenet, all are welcome, and we welcome all. We are comrades in arms, waging a mutual fight with the enemy. And we've come together tonight to share the horrors of war while shoring one another up for another day of battle. There's power in humility. It's one of the toughest lessons I've had to learn. Like the other souls in this room, I live on unsteady ground. Each moment is a choice, and for all my good choices, I'm a single mistake away from having to start my journey all over again. As someone who's relapsed twice, I know better than anyone I can't afford to be cocky or negligent. No matter where I go, these meetings, this group, these strangers who aren't really strangers, are my key to survival. Meetings have different focuses. This meeting was listed in the pamphlet as Big Book, meaning we'll take turns reading out loud, followed by discussion. I've lost count of how many times I've gone through the giant tome at this point, but this format is still one of my favorites. There's something soothing in revisiting words written 80 years ago that still resonate today. I can already feel my shoulders coming down, the pressure in my chest easing. I'm finally with my own people, all dozen of us, young, old, black, white, rich, poor, devout, atheist drunks. An older gentleman sits at the head table. He has the look of a long-timer. He starts us off with a serenity prayer, which sounds even more beautiful in French-accented English. Then we shift into meeting mode. I take my turn reading out loud, though my voice is slightly shaky.
We are at the beginning of the big book, the chapter introducing the true nature of the disease and the terrible treachery that lies in the alcoholic mind. I agree wholeheartedly. My mind is a traitorous beast I must monitor at all times. All those thinking games I used to play. I need a drink. I deserve a drink. I swear I'll stop at just one. Mad, sad, or glad, as the saying goes. We drink because we're lonely. We drink because we fell in love. We drink to help ourselves go to sleep. We drink to wake ourselves up. I drank because it made me feel alive. Then I drank because I didn't want to live anymore. Now I sit here, one day at a time. It feels to me that meeting goers fall into two camps. Those who find comfort in sharing their stories, and those who find comfort in listening to others share stories that could be their own. I'm in the second camp. I rarely talk during the discussion time or volunteer my journey. I genuinely appreciate hearing about others, though, the ways we are all different and yet alike. Tonight, talking about the nature of the disease, allergy, whatever you want to call it, I recognize the classic story elements from my own life. A family legacy of alcoholism. A parent who was a chronic drunk. Another parent who was a chronic enabler. Hitting that awkward, anxious phase of high school. Not knowing who I was or where I belonged. And consequently, tossing back a beer at that party. Or stealing a shot of my parents' liquor before boarding the school bus. That magical, melting feeling that immediately followed. That sense of almost primal recognition. I like this. I want this. I need this. Even now, I remember those first few drinks with longing. Those blissful early days of love before I realized just how toxic and abusive the relationship was about to become. The army guy shares his story of bottoming out, his wife kicking him to the curb, his kids refusing his calls, spending months sleeping on the streets till another vet found him and dragged him to the hospital to begin detox. More nods around the room. I didn't bottom out, as much as I crashed in a series of waves. Low, lower, lowest. By my 20s, my entire lifestyle revolved around booze. I existed to drink and drank to exist. Mostly, I have dark, spiraling memories of neon lights and a strange, hideous laughter ringing in my ears. When I sobered up, it was only to realize that laughter was my own. So, of course, I drank again. Then there was Paul, holding out his hand, offering to save me. In the beginning, it was enough. Later came the hard knowledge that no one can save you from yourself. The meeting reaches the hour mark. We each produce a dollar, toss it in the basket, then rise to standing. I'm curious if this is a Lord's Prayer group or not. The traditional meetings end with it, but more and more groups have drifted away. This is a traditional group. I take the hand of an older black woman to my right and a cab driver with an accent I still don't recognize on my left. We recite the words together, and I use the moment to focus on the feel of a neighbor's hand gripping mine, to remind myself that this hour counts, that my sobriety is worth it, that we are all worth it. The meeting breaks up. We help pile up books, pick up coffee cups. The army vet had coffee prep duty. I move to his side to rinse out the coffee pot while he puts away creamer and sugar. His name is Charlie. I introduce myself again while we clean up together, explaining I've just moved into the area. The meeting leader comes over. He has two pamphlets in his hand, plus a torn piece of notebook paper. A list of daily meetings, he informs me, handing over the green pamphlet. More information on upcoming AA events. The blue pamphlet. I wipe my hands with a paper towel and peruse both brochures. The nice thing about major cities, they have robust AA populations. I didn't have nearly this many choices at my former location, especially these middle-of-the-night meetings, targeting those of us in the restaurant industry who get off after midnight and need support before heading home. Arnold, the man says, sticking out his hand again. Copious introductions is an AA way of life. We all know what it's like to feel lost in a crowd. Frankie, and thank you also for the phone list. I hold up the notebook sheet.
Top one's mine. Third is Charlie's.
The vet nods at me.
Second here, that's Ariel.
He points to the woman who'd been wearing a chef's apron. She crosses over to shake my hand.
You need anything?
Arnold gestures to the phone list, indicating I should feel free to use it. Thank you, I say, and I mean it. 10 days, 10 months, 10 years, you never know when the next craving is going to hit, and in those moments, a single connection can make all the difference. Even after our relationship ended, I'd often call Paul. 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., it hardly mattered. I'd dial his number, hold the phone next to my ear, listen to the sound of ringing, followed by the click of someone picking up on the other end. He didn't speak. He didn't have to. He knew it was me just as I knew it was him. We'd lie in silence together. I'd focus on the sound of his breathing, feel it like his heartbeat against the palm of my hand back in the days when we were still together, and I pressed myself against him in the middle of the night to keep my body, my thoughts, my very sanity from spinning apart. Minute into minute, until it was enough. Then I'd hang up the phone and be separate once more. 2 weeks ago, after Lainey Whitehorse's funeral, when the work was done and my goal accomplished and I lay in bed in my cheap motel room, feeling all the emptiness and sadness crash down upon me, I called his number again. Except this time, there wasn't silence on the other end. This time, a woman picked up. She said, "You need to stop this." Then, not unkindly, "You need help." I hung up the phone, my heart racing wildly in my chest. Then I curled up in the fetal position and burst into tears. The truth can be like that. "Hey," I say now, addressing the three people before me. "I need to buy a new phone, something simple and cheap, like a burner. Do you know where I can get one?"
"There's a T-Mobile around the corner,"
Ariel mentions. She's buttoning up a light jacket. "Sounds expensive." Arnold doesn't say anything, but Charlie the vet nods. I figured it would be him. Funny how any addict can spot a dealer. We are crazy good judges of character. Just don't ask us about ourselves. I hang back with Charlie as Arnold and Ariel hit the stairs.
"How cheap you looking?"
Charlie asks, moving over to the light switch. "Very. I'm just now back to work, so extremely low on funds.
I do some volunteering at the rec center,"
Charlie says, flipping out the lights and herding me toward the stairs.
"I've heard the kids talk about after-hours phones."
"After hours?"
"After closing hours. You'll find a guy or two lurking outside the mobile carriers. They have old phones with new SIM cards. Now, I mean old phones, flip phones, that kind of thing."
I nod.
"A lot of kids pick those up. Can use them for a month or two at 10, 20 bucks a pop."
I'm thinking if I'm a teenage girl embarking on a secret life with limited funds, that's an excellent price point. I drop my voice in a pseudo whisper. "Do I ask for Marco or just look for the guy in the trench coat?" Charlie grins at me. I like his beard. It fits nicely with his broad face, hulking build. He would make an excellent teddy bear.
"Little thing like you needs to be careful asking around. Some of these kids are in the life for sure."
I'm assuming he means gangbangers, which makes sense. Additional funding for illegal activities. "I'm not threatening," I assure him. "Any kid looking to build his rep is hardly going to bother with a scrawny middle-aged white woman. Frankly, it'd be too embarrassing."
Charlie grins again.
Not so wrong, little lady. Not so wrong.
You work at the rec center? I ask as we exit the church. He locks up behind us.
Volunteer 3 afternoons a week. Try to do my part to set these boys straight. I've lived here most of my life. Seen the good, the bad, the ugly. I know what they're going through.
Ever meet Angelique Badeau?
The missing girl?
Charlie stops, looks at me.
Why are you asking about her?
I heard about the case. It made me curious.
I saw her around the center,
Charlie says slowly.
But can't say that I know more than that.
Could I stop by, look around?
Don't see why not. Best time is after school hours or on the weekend, if you're looking to see the kids.
Charlie studies me. Maybe he hopes I'm looking to mentor girls or volunteer my time or talk responsible drinking with teens. He's not sure about my questions, however. Some internal radar clearly pinging to life. Liars are very good at spotting other liars. He doesn't push it, though. Maybe the next time we meet. We're outside the church now, standing on a broad avenue. I have 8 blocks between here and Stoney's to cover. The first of those streets is bathed in streetlights, but quickly fades into a tunnel of black. I stick my hands in my jacket pockets, square my shoulders. Now or never.
I can walk with you,
Charlie offers. I shake my head. I'm good. I don't have far to go, and I have a few tricks up my sleeve. Charlie is clearly torn on the subject, but we've just met, and part of being an addict is learning the importance of boundaries. His job is to take care of him, just like my job is to take care of me. We will both be the better for it. He finally shrugs, heading in the opposite direction. I let him go first, watching his bulk shuffle into the dark. Then I set off at a much more rapid pace. The first block is empty of pedestrians, just cars passing by, some slowing down, some speeding up, all of which I pointedly ignore. Off the lighted boulevard now, onto a smaller, darker residential street. No shadows peel off from the dark. No footsteps echo around me. I keep hustling, block by block. 2 streets from my destination, I spot 4 figures ahead. They are clumped near a tree at the corner of an overgrown lot. Definitely men, but other than that, it's too dark to tell. Their attention is on one another, not seeming to notice me as I cross to the other side to put more distance between us. There is something so furtive about the group that the hairs rise instinctively on the back of my neck. One of them has his pants down around his knees. I don't want to see more, yet I can't look away. Then I spy it, faintly illuminated by a distant porch light, a needle jammed into the inside of the man's thigh, followed by an ecstatic look on the man's face. His companions shift closer, one already reaching for the needle, anticipating his turn. I pass on by. They never notice. Just 5 addicts sharing a brief moment that 4 of them will never remember. I make it to my apartment, close the door behind me, and, remembering to leave my socks on, finally crash exhausted into bed. The low rumble of an engine. I hear it, followed by a weight, solid and warm on top of my chest. Good night, Piper, I murmur. More rumbling. Then we both fall asleep again. Chapter 10. In the morning, Piper has once again vanished off the bed. Not wanting to repeat yesterday's mistake, I climb off the end of the mattress, taking as big a step as possible onto the floor. No claws lash out. I move gingerly around the bed to the kitchen area and notice 2 things at once. The water bowl needs to be refilled, and there are 2 disemboweled mice in the middle of the ancient hardwoods. Viv hadn't been kidding. Piper earns her keep. Am I supposed to be impressed? I call out to my roommate.
And what do I do now? Throw away the corpses? Fashion the ears into a necklace?
I find a plastic grocery bag in one of the kitchen drawers and reluctantly use it to pick up the remains. That still leaves me with a brownish-red smear. Definitely gross. I jump quickly into the shower before my feline roommate can make any more statements. 10 a.m. I have 5 hours before I need to report to work and many investigative paths to pursue. I want to follow up on after-hour cell phones, though it sounds like that might have to wait for a free evening. I also have more questions for the family now that I'm getting the lay of the land. I wonder if Gerline would let me go through Angelique's room. I remember Angelique doesn't really have a room, but she must still have stuff in the living room, that sort of thing. Most people don't realize what a financial luxury privacy is. An individual bedroom, time alone, designated workspace, these things cost money. Angelique got to sleep in a shared family room while probably doing homework on the kitchen table on a refurbished laptop after her brother had his turn, meaning that if she wanted to keep secrets, a diary might not be out of the question. The police had to have gone through her things, her aunt and brother too, but this is where a fresh pair of eyes doesn't hurt. Maybe I could get Gerline to meet me at the apartment on her lunch break, which would make this morning a